Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Patrick Henningsen here, your host. 2 hours live and direct. We're going to hit it hard, news and analysis. I want to say TFI Fridays, but this is kind of a disturbing Friday, as you'll soon find out. There's news afoot right now that is a little bit disconcerting, to say the least. According to U.S. sources, and this is breaking, apparently Iran is within hours, according to the latest reports, hours of hitting targets in Israel. This is according to U.S. sources. So again, we're going to take that somewhat with a pinch of salt at the moment. But again, a huge Iranian counterstrike against Israel expected within hours, say sources in Washington. Let me give you some more details on this. And by the way, we're going to discuss this with award-winning journalist Yusuf Mowry from Yemen. He's going to be joining us, a Middle East expert, in a couple of minutes. We'll probably connect him in the bottom of the half an hour. We're also going to hopefully connect Syrian girl to talk about this. She's just penned an excellent piece at Al-Mayadeen on this very subject, breaking story. And so we're getting all the hottest takes right now from the journalists that are on the ground or commenting on this with intimate knowledge of the situation. So Iran could launch a massive strike on Israeli soil within the next 24 or 48 hours, according to U.S. officials. They've said this today, this morning, in fact. So Tehran has been threatening a harsh response as Israel struck its embassy in Damascus, killing senior Iranian generals and officials in that illegal strike against international law in the Vienna Convention. No censure from the U.S. on this, unfortunately, nor the U.N. Security Council. So this is the situation. U.S. intelligence have said that Iran would target Israeli interests in the Middle East. What does that mean? Does that mean another diplomatic facility in a third country? Is this a possibility, sir? That would be certainly an escalation that a lot of people could live with and stave off this confrontation, which now seems almost like it's inevitable, but hopefully not. Not if the United States intervenes. More on that shortly. But anyway, this story is breaking. We'll hear more about this from our expert guests on this. So we've assembled a good panel. In the first hour, in the second hour, we're going to be joined by independent State Department correspondent in Washington. I'm sure he's going to want to weigh in on this story as well. Sam Husseini is going to join us. We're initially slated to talk about the International Courts of Justice, the case Nicaragua took, and looks like they've taken down Germany in the ICJ. An imminent defeat certainly looks like it's on the cards for Germany and also a number of other important topics that Sam Husseini will be joining us to talk about in the second hour. So definitely looking forward to that discussion. Now, before we connect our next guest, we'll take a short break in a moment to connect our first guest. Hopefully we'll get a hold of Syrian girl. She's going to join us right now in just a few minutes as well. So this is what's happening, folks. And we've got a lot to talk about on this front. We'll also hopefully share some additional analysis with you even after the program through our various channels. So again, this is an ongoing breaking story. U.S. officials say that Iran is set to launch a salvo against multiple targets inside Israel within 24 or 48 hours. Now, again, this is a timeline that looks like it could depend on diplomatic intervention. Certainly, I'm not ruling that out. I don't think anybody should. But rather than fan the flames of war, there's plenty of hawks around, and I'm sure we'll be talking to a hawk or two today, at least to a certain degree. But anyway, on the U.S. front, things aren't looking any better domestically. The House of Representatives in the United States is passed a 2-year surveillance law extension without a warrant required. So warrantless wiretapping. Speaker Mike Johnson scaled back the measure to 2 years from the 5 after Donald Trump had argued Republicans to kill the bill. Unfortunately, they didn't kill it. This is the bipartisan Rhino Democratic consensus. This is the corruption of the swamp. You can see it right now. After an effort to require warrants for FISA warrants for wiretapping of Americans, And basically it failed on a tie vote. So you can see how corrupt the U.S. Congress is on this. This shouldn't be a tie vote. This thing should be killed. Anyway, look, in a majority turnaround, according to the New York Times, the House on Friday, today, passed a two-year reauthorization of an expiring warrantless surveillance law that had stalled this week amid GOP resistance. The Democrats were all for warrantless wiretapping. All Democrats appear to support this. Very popular among Democrats, especially if it means surveilling their opposition's political campaigns. That actually happened, ladies and gentlemen. Operation Crossfire Hurricane, FISA Gate, Spygate with George Papadopoulos, just to name a few. We'll talk to George hopefully next week about this very issue, but only after narrowly rejecting a bipartisan effort to restrict searches of Americans' messages swept up by the program, hoovering up America's data, American messages without warrants. This is now seen as perfectly fine by the majority of lawmakers in Washington. So boy, have we fallen from where our founding fathers intended us to be in the U.S. The bill would extend a provision of the law known as Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that's FISA, that is set to lapse next Friday. Rather than allow it to lapse, lawmakers have opted instead to keep the authoritarian measures, the police state measures, going to surveil, it looks like, for the Democrats anywhere, the Biden administration, to surveil the political opposition during the national election coming up. Ladies and gentlemen, this is dire, very bad, bad, bad development, to say the least. So this kind of tells you where America's at in terms of its democracy. And it can't be waxing lyrical around the world, talking about its principles and the rules-based international order, etc., if they can't even manage to string a democracy together at home. These are the exact things that nearly destroyed, and they're not done yet, but nearly before, destroyed our political system in the U.S. and really broke all the rules, threw the rule book out, in fact, and politicized and weaponized pretty much every agency in the federal government that had anything nearly to do with law enforcement. That's what happened during the Trump administration. And then the Mueller probe, the Russiagate hoax, it's all connected to this very FISA gate. And here we go. Rather than kill it, rather than reset the system and let us get back to normality, no. The bipartisan consensus, the uniparty in the swamp, decided to breathe new life into it. Breathe new life into it. Unbelievable. A real low point, at least for 2024. Meanwhile, the other half of the legislation is clamoring for World War III. Go figure. The timing of these two events, well, let's just say it's not a coincidence. Let's take a break right now with TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Kinnickson, your host. We'll be right back.
Jason Olborn.
Former Liberal Democrat Senator David Leinhelm, who was the first Liberal Democrat senator, he wrote a book on gun control a couple of years ago. And I would have to say, from an Australian perspective, it is the definitive book on the subject. And we're going to talk about that in line with another pressing thing that happened for us here in Australia just a week or so ago, with the digital ID bill being passed in the Senate in its first reading as opposed to the House of Representatives, and leading to many people saying that in Australia it may be that this push is on because we don't have access to arms. It's an interesting argument, isn't it? And what I noticed was that it was coming not only from Australian social media, but also from people in the United States, where there's been this pressure ongoing for gun control in that country.
Weekends with Jason Olborn on Today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was going to make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like LaToya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
LaToya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
My character Shazam knows all about growing up in a family full of teenage superheroes. They're bold.
Where's everyone going?
To fight crime.
Okay.
Adventurous.
Shazam!
There's never a dull moment. And no matter what happens, they'll always have your back. All they need is a place to grow and be themselves. And the best part is, you don't have to be a superhero to adopt a teen. Learn more about adopting a teen from foster care. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward.
Now I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're still in hour number one of this live broadcast. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. Thank you for rejoining us. And as I said before the break, the top story right now in the world, well, it has to be the top story in the world. I think we're very much on the precipice of potentially of a third world war. I don't say that lightly. And I know this is some alternative pundits hyperbolically announced this on a weekly basis for the last 10 years. I won't mention any names, but actually this is the real deal. We are looking at a situation, according to U.S. sources, that Iran might hit multiple Israeli targets within the next 24 to 48 hours. What does this mean? This is a level of potential conflict here that will almost certainly drag in the major powers alongside Israel, their ally. I'm talking about the United States of America, Great Britain, etc. This is going to put the whole world on absolute war footing if this happens. The question is, can it be averted? Is it possible to de-escalate? I want to point to our next guest right now. She has just penned an excellent op-ed for Al Mayadeen, which is a fantastic Middle East news site. And the title of her article, which is on this very topic, Iran consulate bombing, Israel's act of desperation, Maram Susli, a.k.a. Syrian Girls, joining us on the live link right now. Syrian Girl, how are you?
Thank you so much for having me here. And thank you for that excellent introduction as well. Yes, Al Mayadeen is a Lebanese satellite TV and Britain news website, and I'm very proud to have written for them.
No, it's an excellent piece, but also the seriousness of this can't be underestimated, as you well know. I know that you've also been running a massive public forum on X Twitter Spaces in the early hours of this morning, so we appreciate the fact that you're available for us for this segment, Syrian Girl. What do you make of this situation right now? This is kind of new territory. We haven't been here before. The risks are huge. The ramifications are far-reaching. What do you make of this current impasse right now, this weekend?
I think you described it very accurately, in fact. You know, it is possibly bringing us to the brink of World War III. And the mechanism by which this could happen is that, you know, Israel does have nukes. We know that they are unhinged in their activity in the last 6 months has shown that they're not really a rational actor. So, and it's first of all, an attack on them could trigger a nuclear response and then hence a nuclear war. We know they have the Samson option. They could target multiple targets around the world. And as a result, you know, nukes are flying. Suddenly, everyone's nukes are flying. The other mechanism by which this could happen is slower than that. The American Zionist lobby is going to drag the US into war. I believe the UK may be involved as well. And, this war would certainly not necessarily save Israel either, because, they will attack Iran navally by the air. But Iran will still be able to target Israel, and the population of Iran outnumbers Israel times 10. They have far more capabilities, and they can definitely wipe Israel off the map, as they say, no matter what the United States does. So, at the same time, Iran is an ally of Russia and China, and they would definitely, at the moment, the Russian soldiers are near the Golan Heights. They have reinforced that area, and that is also territory that's been occupied by Israel within Syria. So, as well as the fact that the U.S. is illegally occupying Syria as well. So Russia could certainly be dragged into this war if the United States goes in too.
So when we talk about militaries, it's accepted by many people here in America, Syrian girl, that Israel has the most powerful military in the Middle East, bar none, that Iran is really a ramshackle sort of second-rate regional power. But is that really the case? And what about Iran's missile capabilities? Do they have intermediate range and hypersonic missile capabilities? And if so, what does that mean in terms of bypassing Israelis' missile defense array and their Iron Dome, et cetera, strategically? What can you tell us about this?
Well, they have several weapons options they can use. They have the, as you called it, the hypersonic missiles. They're ballistic missiles. They basically go up into the stratosphere and they come down with kinetic force onto the target. These were used on the U.S. military base in Iraq, the Al-Assad Air Base, in 2021 as a response to Soleimani's assassination. And these missiles would certainly bypass the Iron Dome simply because, the speed and the kinetic force that they have, the Iron Dome wouldn't be able to stop them. Second form of missile that they can use are cruise missiles. And these actually have AI that can dodge the air defense systems of the Israelis. And finally, they have drones. They have the Shahed drones, which again can be are completely maneuverable and can dodge the Iron Dome system and as well as overwhelm it. And of course, Iran is not alone. It's going to be coordinating with the resistance axis. And so they can launch, as Hezbollah has done in the last hour, consecutive missile volleys to overwhelm the Iron Dome at the same time. So all of these options are available. And, this is not like 15 years ago when maybe you could say that Israel is more powerful than Iran. Iran has developed its own, air defense capabilities, its own offensive capabilities, to the point where even the Russians are relying on that technology to fight a war in Ukraine. So really, Iran is strong neighborly, and with this missile systems, and now with the drones, more so than Israel.
So this is interesting because this is the problem that Ukraine is having. They've depleted their Patriot missile batteries, which are supplied by the United States. Likewise, Israel's defense systems are supplied, the munitions are supplied by the United States. And so you said in the last hour or so, last couple of hours, Hezbollah sent a volley into Israel. So they could, in theory, do this between the various resistance axis members, including Hamas, to deplete or to sort of, drain the Iron Dome of its munitions and therefore create an open target really for the Iranians at a time of their choosing. Is this a viable scenario?
Well, I think so. And one must remember that every one of those missiles in the Iron Dome costs something about $60,000 to $70,000 for the U.S. taxpayer. And it is the U.S. taxpayer that's footing the bill for the Iron Dome, which is interesting because the U.S. doesn't have its own Iron Dome system. Certainly, the U.S. soldiers that are stationed in the Middle East aren't being protected by this Iron Dome. So, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead and finish, Siringo.
Well, just, in finality, it certainly seems that, Iran is bound to retaliate at this point. If you read the geopolitical atmosphere, it seems like it is inevitable. And so one would think that, overwhelming the Iron Dome system would have to be one of the things that Iran does.
So what Israel did here, what started this particular round of hostilities, was Israel hitting an Iranian embassy in Damascus, killing two Iranian high-ranking generals, in fact, and senior people. And that's a diplomatic facility. It's a total contravention of international treaties and international law. So Israel started this particular round of hostilities. But just the fact that the United States is lobbying to Iran to show restraint in terms of, hitting targets in Israel, et cetera, and everybody's now stressed out and worried about this. Doesn't this in itself show that Iran has a tremendous amount of leverage? Why I'm saying this, Syrian girl, is if Iran makes a back-channel agreement to not strike Israel, what would Iran want in return as a quid pro quo, a ceasefire in Gaza? Or would we be into some kind of protracted chess game of negotiations, which, let's face it, you wouldn't want to be playing that game with Israel, because, quite frankly, in the past, they don't play by the rules when it comes to such negotiations. But what about Iran's leverage? What would they want in return if they were to show restraint?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Sometimes such a thing happens just before negotiations take place in order to weaken the position of the other party. So perhaps the strategic thinking was, you attack Iran in a brazen way, this intimidates Iran, and so when they come to the table for negotiations, they're going to take a weaker deal. And this sort of thing happened while the United States is dangling a few concessions at Iran with Egypt. They're trying to make a treaty with Hamas in terms of a ceasefire, but a temporary ceasefire with 40 hostages or prisoners of war exchanged for the hostages of Palestinians that Israel is holding. So that was floated. Also, they would try to make some concessions to the Yemeni forces, the Houthis or Ansarullah. That is their other alternative, more official name. So, but neither of those things succeeded. And so, the ceasefire has to be permanent. Maybe that might prevent a retaliation by Iran. The problem that the U.S. is going to face is the fact that the resistance axis is not under complete control of Iran. They have also their own autonomous voices. So even if they were to strike a deal with one faction of the axis, that's not going to necessarily stop the Iranians from looking out for their own interests. And what they attacked is as you said, Iran's diplomatic facility, and that is an act of war. And without answering to that, no matter what they dangle in front of the resistance axis, without answering to that, Iran is going to immediately be in a weaker position. So they've on purpose or inadvertently sort of forced Iran's hand to come forward and join the resistance axis in its attacks on Israel.
So if that's the case, we might be in for a surprise or two, Syrian girl, in the coming weeks. And who knows where this is going to end in terms of the ladder of escalation. And this is something that a lot of people are concerned about. What about, lastly, before we break, and we thank you for your time, what about the U.S. intervening at the last minute in order to restrain Israel if Iran decides to actually retaliate and that happens? Then would that wake up the United States? I mean, I can't imagine a situation where the U.S. would want to see a full-scale war in the region where they get dragged in, especially during an election year. Your final thoughts on this?
Well, clearly the United States is planning or seeing that Iran has chosen to retaliate because, if you recall, just prior to Soleimani's retaliation for Soleimani's death, Trump was, first of all, threatening Iran to destroy their heritage sites. At the same time, he was using all diplomatic means to outreach to Iran, including getting a diplomatic group from Switzerland to try to convince them not to retaliate. Now, something similar happened recently with Blinken appealing to China to try to get them to request Iran not to retaliate. So there's a certain level of desperation there. And with the United States saying that they're fully committed to Israel, and UK jumping in as well, you know, you have to tend to believe that the US is being begrudgingly dragged into a war that they don't want, because this war is going to be extremely unpopular with Biden's voting base. And this is an election year. So this might be the end of his presidency, especially because most Democrats are pro-Palestinian, in spite of their leaders not being pro-Palestinian. So, and also the Republican side as well are also growing tired of Israel. The GOP, Israel is also losing the GOP. So I just think that the United States is in a very precarious position. However, with power of the Zionist lobby being as it is, I'm afraid that it's probably likely that the U.S. will be dragged into that war. But as a result of that, what's going to happen is, you know, they're not going to be able to save Israel from the war if it expands. They're not going to be able to stop Iran from wreaking havoc on Zionist entity. But also, their U.S. soldiers who are now stationed in Syria and Iraq and Jordan, those soldiers are going to, their lives are going to be under threat. And there's going to be devastation if, because, you know, if the U.S. attacks Iran, what happened the last time the U.S. attacked Iran? Iran attacks the U.S. And that's what's going to happen.
That's right. And the last time Iran hit the U.S. base, the U.S. did not respond when they hit the al-Assad air base in Iraq. They didn't respond. They couldn't respond. So what makes them think they're in a better strategic position now than they were before? They're probably not. And that's the reality. And I think that's going to factor in Washington as well. It's going to be very interesting. This is an extremely concerning period right now. We really appreciate you joining us, Syrian girl, and your input, as always, extremely valuable. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
There she goes, ladies and gentlemen. That is Syrian Girl. Follow her on X, Twitter, Partisan Girl, at Partisan Girl. And also watch for her alerts on X Spaces. She is hosting some of the best geopolitical spaces right now on that platform. So you definitely want to be following her and also spread the word. Let's take a break right now. We're going to connect our next guest, award-winning journalist from Yemen, Youssef Mowry, is going to join us in just a few minutes. We'll continue this conversation about the geopolitics, the tension rising in the Middle East. I'm Patrick Henningsen. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received two stents in my arteries, stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome. Prediabetes does. One in three adults has prediabetes, but with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. And you can change the outcome. Take the 1 minute prediabetes risk test today. Go to doihaveprediabetes.org.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We're still in the first hour of this live broadcast. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. Again, the breaking story today, which we are covering closely, is the rising tension in the Middle East. And again, we'll go to our source right now from the news feeds. U.S. officials have told numerous news agencies, including CBS News in the United States, that Iran is ready for a counterstrike on Israel, expected within hours. Hundreds of drones, dozens of missiles could rain down on Israel over this weekend. It is uncertain whether this will happen right now in 24 hours, 48 hours. It could even happen next week. But the point is, the region, in fact, the world, is on high alert right now. We just spoke to Merim Susli, aka Syrian Girl, to get her take on it. And again, we'll drop her op-ed with Al-Mayadeen in the TNT chat community, so you guys can check that out and read that for yourself. Right now, however, I want to bring on to the call award-winning journalist Youssef Mowry, who's joining us right now from Yemen to weigh in on this important story. Youssef, thank you very much for coming on.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Youssef, let's just break this down. Where are we right now with this story? And what do you see in terms of tension, in terms of escalation? What do you see happening over the next week? Is there a chance to dial this down? If so, what needs to happen? Your thoughts.
Well, I think something that really stands out is that Iranian Islamic religious leader, Sayyid Khomeini, he came out and he said that Iran would respond back and that Israel would be slapped in the face and would suffer consequences for its attack on the consulate, the Iranian consulate in Damascus. So that's the first time I've heard the spiritual leader of Iran's Islamic revolution issue such a statement. Taking into consideration the tensions, the rising tensions that have unfolded over the past week and a half, I think it's very clear to the West, to Israel, and to the rest of the world that an Iranian strike on Israel, it's not just going to be a strike carried out only by Iran. This will be an Iranian strike, which is going to be launched from places like Yemen, from Palestine, from Lebanon, from Syria, and from Iraq. So the flood of Al-Aqsa, the operation that launched on October 7th, it seems like it's turning into a tsunami. Because when you have all these factions in the Middle East, especially in Yemen, they've managed to successfully weaken the strength, the brute domination of Western Israeli imperialism over the Middle East. I think when, you know, it's no secret that Israel has been trying to provoke Iran for decades. You know, I remember, you know, 15 years ago, Israel, 20 years ago, Israel trying to provoke a war with Iran. And obviously they're pushing the West, their Western allies, but, you know, with the U.S., because they know that the U.S. and the British and the other Western nations, they will be at the forefront. They'll be at the vanguard to attack Iran. So, but that plan is not going as smoothly as Israel has hoped for, because I think when Israel was planning to provoke a war with Iran and gather its troops, its allies to wage this military attack on Iran, I don't think they were expecting that allies of Iran in Yemen would be able to take over or to limit access to Western powers in the Red Sea, in the Gulf of Aden, in the Indian Sea, the Arabian Sea, because these are strategic waterways. These are strategic seas that the U.S., Israel, and the British government need access to, and they need the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, in order for them to carry out any type of successful military operation against Iran. If they are cut, if they are cut off from the Red Sea, from the Gulf of Aden, from Bab el-Mandeb, it's going to make their military operations a lot harder, because now you're losing logistics, you're losing maritime traffic, you no longer have access, it's no longer easy to transport weapons on a massive scale through the Red Sea. So that's going to be a huge inconvenience for a long type of a military confrontation with Iran. And not to mention, Israel has failed to eliminate Hamas in occupied Palestine, in the besieged Gaza Strip. So if it's becoming very clear to the world that Israel is losing, because we see videos every single day of Hamas posting where they're basically eliminating Israeli soldiers, tanks, armored vehicles. And this is something that seems to be happening on a daily basis in the midst of, you know, just carpet bombing an entire city. So now add Iran into the equation. You know, if you can't even get rid of Hamas in the besieged Gaza Strip, and you lost the 2006 war against Lebanon's Hezbollah, now these forces are all going to join together for an attack on Israel. And I think this was in accordance to Israel's original plan with regards to a military confrontation with Iran. I think they were expecting that the majority of the Arab and the Middle Eastern countries would side with Iran, and that is the case, believe it or not, as we know. I wouldn't say it's necessarily the case now as it was before, but we still do have Saudi Arabia, countries like the UAE, Jordan, and even Egypt. Although they've issued public statements in condemnation of Israel, if it came to a large-scale full war with Iran, these Arab proxy regimes would side with the U.S. and would side with Israel. But I think it's sort of a balance between the two axes as we speak, because Iran has Yemen, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, Iraq, and they've proven that they're able to deliver devastating blows.
Certainly, yes. Whether Saudi Arabia would want to side with Israel and the U.S., they would pretty much be pinned down by Yemen. That's pretty clear after 9 years of this war that's ended in a catastrophic failure for Saudi Arabia in the U.S. But let me ask you this, Yusuf. Clearly, it seems like you made the case that Israel's losing the war in Gaza, much to the chagrin of everybody that's been saying the opposite of that, that they've been winning, that Hamas is totally defeated, and all these various announcements that the IDF withdrawing from Gaza, then they're back in northern Gaza, then out, then into the south, and back in the north. So they're playing this chess game with the press, with the United States. But the reality is, if they are losing, then don't they have an incentive to create a provocation to draw the United States into a direct confrontation with Iran? Because that would make life a lot easier, wouldn't it, for Israel in the current predicament that they're in? And isn't that the big danger here? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree with you. The U.S. is in a very bad situation. They're in between a rock and a hard place. And the reason for that is because of the very reasons that you've articulated. So the only thing they've succeeded in Gaza is just killing almost 40,000 innocent civilians. So, yes, I think everybody knows that Israel is trying to drag Iran into the war. But just because those are the intentions of Israel, it doesn't mean that just because Israel wants to provoke a war with Iran, or that it wants to drag Iran into a war so that it could spark a region war, that is just going to sit back and allow its sovereignty to be violated. I think it's taken a step forward to say to Israel, okay, if this is what you want, if you want war, then war is what you will get. Because the strategy of just being reluctant to strike back, keeping in mind that, you know, Israel, Mossad has been waging these assassinations high-ranking Iranian military officials across the Middle East. They've done this a number of times. They did this with Qasem Soleimani. They did this with a number of other high-ranking Iranian officials, and Iran has sat back and been patient because they know that they know that Israel wants to spark a war between Iran and the U.S. because the U.S. is just not the U.S. is not going to allow Iran to destroy Israel or to destroy the Israeli regime, the IDF. So that's the that's the bad situation, the bad position that the U.S. is in, because the U.S. is just unable to break free from the global Zionist lobby control. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense when you think about it realistically. How is it that the U.S., the beacon, so-called beacon democracy, the country that, the people, they choose their own political character, the people they choose, which, if their military should engage in a war. It's just mind-boggling when you see that Israel's committing genocide and at the same time dragging the Americans into perhaps what would be the biggest war, one of the biggest wars in American history with Iran, because a war with Iran, it's not just going to be a war with Iran. It's going to be a war with Yemen, with Lebanon, with Iraq, and with other Muslim factions across the Middle East. And I can tell you now, just from putting the ear to the ground and just getting the general vibe of Yemenis and other Arabs would tell you the same thing. Iran is growing very popular. Iran is starting, their cause is starting to make sense to even those who were against Iran. I'm talking about those even in some of the Gulf countries, because they're starting to see that Iran, if they're able to actually wage a direct attack on Israel, then Iran is cashing the check that they've written. It's delivering on the promise that they promised they would deliver on if their sovereignty is attacked, because some Arab regimes and some of the Arab people, they're constantly saying that Iran is not serious. Iran is not going to attack. Iran is
Yeah. Well, they'll say that, but Iran has acted previously, and the U.S. has not responded to those actions because they couldn't strategically. Let me ask you this, Yusuf. If Iran was to choose a high value target within Israel, or more than one high value target, what do you think that might be? Would they opt for a military target, or would they opt for an infrastructure target or something like this? What do you think the thinking would be in terms of the quid pro quo?
I think Iran is preparing for a long-term war with Israel. And we can base that just from the inception of the Islamic Republic of Iran, their revolution. It was launched and it was established specifically for the purpose of liberating the land of Al-Aqsa, liberating Palestine from Israeli occupation. That's basically the gel that keeps this whole Iranian activism across the Middle East. And not only that, they launched their revolution to also, with the goal of eliminating the U.S. military and political dominance over the Muslim world, right? And also their third objective is to unite the Muslim world, economy, political, military positions in global affairs. Now, in order for them to achieve that third goal, the first thing that they have to do, and they realize this is part of their manifesto, the first thing they had to do is establish allies in the region, establish allies that are able to share the same cause, the same sentiments, and the same long-term goals. And Iran came with the sentiment of liberating the land of Palestine. And that's a sentiment and a belief and a goal of every Muslim across the, not just the Middle East, but across the Muslim world, because they believe Palestine is a land of land being illegally occupied by the Israeli regime. They're being backed by the U.S., by the British government. And it is the Islamic obligation, the humanitarian obligation of the Muslim world to unite, to bring an end to this imminent threat, also because it's the third holiest Muslim site. So it becomes a dear goal and a sentiment to every Muslim. And this was the message that resonated with the Muslim world upon the establishment of the Islamic Iranian Revolution in 1979. And now we're starting to see the allies of Iran, ones here in Yemen, Lebanon, and other parts of the Middle East, they're starting to act militarily. And that's something that's new. It's a new phenomenon for Muslims to see most other Muslim countries, other Muslim factions take a stance to defend Palestine, to defend the Palestinians, and to defend Muslims' holy sites. When you add to the mix that these attacks, you know, in the Red Sea, these military operations from factions in Syria and Iraq have been successful and have attacked Israeli military sites inside of Israel, it's only adding more fuel to the fire in terms of more Muslims and perhaps even more factions in the near future joining this so-called axis of resistance and joining allies with Iran. Now, to answer your question directly, where is Iran going to attack? I think what would make sense for a military operation is, first and foremost, they need to clear the Golan Heights from Israeli presence, from Israeli forces. Because if they're able to clear the Golan Heights from military presence and Israeli forces, what that does is it opens a corridor into the heart of occupied Palestine. Basically, Iran and its allies would then be able to actually send military troops to confront the Israeli regime through military mobilization on the ground, through the access points in Syria, through the Golan Heights. There's a reason why the Golan Heights has been occupied by Israel for many years. It's because if they don't have control of the Golan Heights, then you basically, that leaves Israel susceptible to a military invasion by the Muslim world through Syria.
Right. So strategically, and that's notable, Yusuf, that Russia has moved forces in two battalions, I believe, into the Golan Heights, or multiple battalions into the Golan Heights just in the last few weeks. So that's a significant move. Perhaps Russia did this in anticipation of something very much a scenario like what you're seeing now. It's well known or understood that Russia and Iran are allies. So that could change the calculus as well. Certainly that would also draw the attention and the efforts of the United States into possibly a confrontation with Russia. But incredibly sensitive. I know we only got a couple of minutes left, Yusuf. First of all, I want to get your comment on Russia's presence in Syria, how that factors in. And I want to talk about the Bab-el-Mandeb Straits, as you mentioned before, absolutely crucial in the exchanges between Ansar Allah, the Yemeni forces, and the U.S. and the British and the French and the other sort of European naval powers in there. What has happened over the last couple of months? What sort of blows have been dealt to the U.S. and Israel and its allies in terms of that waterway, that key waterway, which you just described? But just before we go, Russia and Syria, and how did Ansarullah fare against the Western naval forces? Go ahead, Yusuf.
Well, just like we've seen Russia's role in this, you know, in the war that was launched against the Assad regime from 2011, for 12 years, Russia maintained a presence in Syria because they understood the game. They understood that this was an Israeli-U.S. plot in order to overthrow the Assad regime and replace that regime with an Israeli backed regime that would weaken the position, be seldom power, be given weapons, just like the Israeli regime is receiving billions and billions of weaponry aid from the U.S. If the Assad regime collapsed and you had a new government, Western-backed government installed in Syria, it would greatly weaken Russia's role, Russia's strength and influence, not just in the perhaps in Syria, but across the world. It would also weaken directly Iran, the axis of resistance, and Hezbollah, and the Hamas and Palestinian resistance, because Syria is how, you know, it's the main corridor where weapons are being transported or smuggled into Palestinian resistance fighters and to Hezbollah in Lebanon. So that's, you know, in short, that's why this so-called revolution erupted in Syria. It's not even a revolution. It was a Western plot, as we see, has been proven empirically. So that's why Russia stepped in to prevent that from happening, because they know that Syria would have been used to attack perhaps Russia, to attack Iranian interests, and it basically would have eliminated any potential threat against Israel. And like I said before, if you're able to take control of the Golan Heights while under the Assad regime, with allies with Russia, allies with the Axis of Resistance, then you would have Yemeni fighters and fighters from the, you know, from the whole of the Muslim world feeling it is necessary to go there and to protect Palestinians. And through the Golan Heights, they would have access to do just that. If the situation is to, you know, escalate, if genocide continues, any Muslim will tell you, whether Sunni or Shiite, that if they had the access to go and help the Palestinians in any way that they can, they just need access. And that's the danger that Syria represents for the Israeli regime, is if the Golan Heights is no longer under Israeli control, then you would have a flood of fighters from the Axis of Resistance and from, you know, across the Muslim world taking part in such military action, especially while the genocide is taking place. And Russia would have no problem with that. Russia would have no problem with that, because considering the alternative, it's definitely in Russia's best interest for them to step in any way that they can to prevent Israel or the U.S. or the British from gaining strategic grounds in Syria, just like they're doing with Ukraine. Likewise, Russia would be able to turn the table and do the same thing to the U.S. and Israel through Syria. To answer your second question with Bab al-Mandab, this is the one card. This is the strategic play that we are seeing unfold that Israel and the West did not see coming. They never expected that their ships, their maritime tracks, would be targeted in the Red Sea, let alone the Gulf of Aden. And what this has done is, in point blank, it has forced the U.S., it has forced Israel to reshuffle and to rethink their military strategy on a potential scale attack on Iran, because they're not going to be able to do that if Bab al-Mandab is closed, if the Strait of Hormuz is closed, and if the Strait of the Suez Canal is also closed from access to Western powers.
Youssef Mowry, award-winning journalist from Yemen, thank you very much for your commentary and your insights on this. Very valuable. We really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us on TNT this week.
Thank you, Patrick. Take care.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Youssef Mowry, fantastic analysis, top of the hour news headlines coming up. And when we come back, more on the other side with Sam Husseini.